Welcome to Pain Talk, where we explore pain through a modern, science-based lens. If you're a healthcare provider or someone living with chronic pain, this podcast is for you. We break down how pain really works, why it can persist, and what helps the nervous system begin to feel safe again, because pain is real. But so is change.
Welcome back to Pain Talk. Today we're exploring one of the most important and often overlooked factors in chronic pain recovery, and that's sleep. Many people living with chronic pain tell me that sleep is one of their greatest challenges. They struggle to fall asleep, wake repeatedly during the night, or wake feeling exhausted, despite spending hours in bed. At the same time, poor sleep often seems to make pain worse the next day, creating a frustrating cycle that can feel impossible to escape. But sleep is more than simply getting enough hours. Like pain, sleep is influenced by our biology, our emotions, our habits, our expectations, stress, and our sense of safety. In fact, many of the same factors that amplify pain can also disrupt sleep. To help us better understand this relationship, I'm joined today by psychologist Dr. David Gardner, whose work focuses on sleep and insomnia. Dr. David Gardner is a professor and community psychiatry research director in the Department of Psychiatry at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He's trained in pharmacy, community health, and epidemiology, and his work focuses on improving mental health care through research, education, and implementation science. He's best known in the sleep field as the co-developer of Sleepwell, a Canadian research and knowledge mobilization initiative designed to help people with insomnia improve sleep using evidence-based approaches such as cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or often it's referred to as CBTI, and to reduce reliance on sleeping pills. The program was developed with Dr. Andrea Murphy and a multidisciplinary team of sleep experts, clinicians, researchers, and people with lived experience. Dr. Gardner is also a member of the Canadian Sleep Research Consortium and an executive member of the Canadian Medical Appropriateness and Deprescribing Network. His research has focused on insomnia management, sleeping pill deprescribing, psychotropic medication safety, and expanding access to evidence-based sleep care. He was recognized by the Center of Addiction and Mental Health as one of Canada's 150 difference makers in mental health and received Dalhousie's Award of Excellence in Education in 2024. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. David Gardner. David, I'm just curious, what got you involved in sleep and sleep research? And because you're so well known throughout the province and even nationally for your work in this area, can you tell us a little bit more about the kind of work that you do?
Yeah, I was just at the New Brunswick Medical Society annual conference at the Algonquin.
Ooh, beautiful place. Yeah.
I've never been there. It knocks your socks off. What a place that is.
And yeah, I'm from St. John, New Brunswick. Yeah. That's my home. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd never driven. So I took the ferry over and I drove from St. John up to St. Andrews. So that was a beautiful drive. What a wonderful part of the country that is. Yeah. So like I know in Atlantic Canada, we're particularly well known. And now when I go across the country, people go, oh, sleep well. You know, I always heard that. So there's quite a few people came up to the booth and they're just so happy to say, they don't know me, but they're so happy to say every day or every second day, I'm talking to a patient about this and I'm referring them to the website. So, you know, the website has done very well for itself. We don't have a marketing budget. You know, we just kind of exist and it's word of mouth. And, you know, for one doc said, this is so weird that you're here. I just heard about this 2 weeks ago and now you're here. And it was my colleague who said, refer your patients to this website. So I went on the website and I looked it over and I went, kind of does look pretty good. So,
Well, you know, the other thing, I don't know if you've had any involvement with the Power Over Pain portal with Dr. Pauline Poulin, I think her name is.
No, but I do know of it. Yeah.
Yeah. They should be actually interviewing you. So they've got tons of webinars for patients that they've actually put on those. So it's a great resource as patients are starting to wait to access care around pain. And obviously sleep is one of those really important areas. So, I mean, I must say when I do in our pain self-management program, when I do the talk on sleep, I always bring your webpage into it. And invariably, probably in my experience anyway, probably 80% of the people that I run into who have lived experiences of chronic pain, but just in general, sleep is a huge issue. So maybe what we can do is come back and say, well, you know, what is sleep and why is it so important?
Yeah, well, you know, like it goes without saying how important sleep is. So When I think of the pillars of health and how our health system and Health Canada and around the world, people have talked about nutrition being critically important and physical activity and exercise being critically important. And there was this third area that was kind of not talked about for the longest time. And Canada actually really has done a favor to the world by coming out with those guidelines for the 24-hour, what we're to do with our time. And sleep is a real top priority in that way. So others are looking at Canada to saying, finally, somebody figured out to actually put sleep there. So sleep is, a system to restore us in so many ways, but biologically, it's so critical. So we know the brain by day is the most active, part of our body. As organs go, it is the big energy user. So we use up so much glucose in our brain, and there's byproducts. Like, this is so natural. There's byproducts, and we rely on it for so many things, in part our immune system, in part our overall metabolic health, and our memory and our ability for it to function in so many ways. So where does that all get balanced in terms of the homeostasis of, by day your brain is functioning well, and by night it's getting ready for the next day? So that's how I think of sleep. Like, it's kind of silly to talk about all of the different health benefits of good sleep because it's so obvious in so many ways. But I really like to think of it as we need to let our brain rest and do what it needs to do during the night so it can be ready to take on such major tasks during the day, from controlling our appetite so that we don't overeat or undereat. We need a good night's sleep so that when we wake up, we feel refreshed and we can organize our day. We can say, well, it's mealtime now. But when you're not well rested, everything's just a little bit on the edge. You feel on the edge. You're going, I don't feel well. Maybe I need to eat a little more. And you don't have the energy to make your meal sort of a priority. So you just kind of make eating a little bit now and a little bit later, and it doesn't turn into a well-balanced meal. Physically, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing during the day because you're canceling plans, you're not going to the gym because you're not feeling well, or you're just not going and socializing. So all of these things start to erode when we're not sleeping well. So by day and by night, we really need to think about what is sleep health and how can we make little tiny changes to make our sleep health just a little bit better. We're not looking for, this is the optimal sleep health that everybody needs. We just need for people to think about what are the components of sleep health and what can I do just to edge closer to having any one of those components get a little bit better.
I mean, I often think about it as one of those pillars. Like when I think about, we're all born with the same blueprint, but our nervous systems are really moving towards that survival, protection, and safety. And so safety can be different things, but when I think about these protective kinds of experiences that we have, pain is an essential part of our protective system. Without it, we would never survive as a species, right? But then I think about hunger, and I think about sleep and reproduction, and like those are essential for human survival. So important.
And managing stress. Like, people say, I don't want to feel stressed. It's like, no, you want to, if you're not feeling stressed, you're not around anymore. We all need to feel stressed because that's part of our life experience. And managing it is difficult without sleep. But when we get sleep, you go, okay, that's going to be a challenge. And somebody just added one more thing to my plate, but I can take that on.
It can appear that somebody is sleeping, but they're not actually getting effective sleep. So can you distinguish between sort of looking like we're sleeping, but actually, we're not really restoring, like that restorative sleep piece? So what's actually happening there, and how do we know when we feel that we've gotten restorative sleep?
Maybe the most important word you just said is feel. So maybe this is a good time to talk about all of the technology and devices that people are bringing in to tell them if they're having a good sleep or not. And sleep is subjective. Sleep is not something that we need to look externally to figure out if we're having a good sleep or not. If you're waking up and you're feeling reasonably rested and reasonably alert, then that's an indication that the 4.5 hours of sleep you just got were good enough to get you through the day. So when we talk about what is restorative sleep, your restorative sleep, Maureen, and mine might be completely different. So you might feel like, oh, I had 9 hours and I still feel awful. And I might say, wow, last night's 6 hours was fine. I feel totally ready for today. But 2 nights ago, I had 6 hours, and I just felt grumpy and slow all day long. So it's way more complex than we recognize, and we try to distill it down to something as simple as we need a certain number of hours. So let me just quickly go through. This came out not too long ago, but there are sort of six main components of sleep health. And if we can think about those components of sleep health, then I think we can sort of understand that it's not just about restorative sleep is this thing, and you need to get into deep wave or slow wave sleep to get a deep sleep to get the restorative sleep. Like when we get to a certain age, our amount of slow wave sleep or deep sleep is basically gone. We're no longer 22 years old and having a substantial proportion of our sleep. But like people don't want to think of it as that, because you can be a 75-year-old and have a great sleep, but next to none of it, if none of it at all, is deep sleep or slow wave sleep. And we're probably down, when you turn 40, you're probably down to maybe half of what you were getting as a teenager. It's natural aging. You might have noticed that I don't have nearly the hair that many people would have when they were 18 years old. It's also part of my natural aging. I could probably do a lot of things to try to get that hair back, but in the end, it really actually doesn't matter at all. I'm still the same person. And if I have way less slow wave sleep or deep sleep, it doesn't mean I'm a bad sleeper just because of that. But if you're looking at a device, what's it telling you? Oh, you didn't get an awful lot of slow wave or deep sleep anymore. And that's the wrong message. So they are. So the six components are satisfaction with sleep. So ultimately, it's a subjective assessment of how you're feeling now after last night's sleep. Daytime alertness is part of that. Sleep timing, this is a really interesting one. So we think of our circadian rhythm as one of our two really important regulatory rhythms for sleep. If you are in the middle of your sleep and it's somewhere between 2 and 4 a.m. in the morning, your circadian rhythm will optimize your day-night balance, your sleep, and support you in feeling well during the day and ready. We're daytime creatures, and so we're used to being asleep during the night. If you're going to sleep at 2 at night, the middle of your sleep is not between 2 and 4. If you're going to sleep at, say, 10 or 11, and you're getting up at 6 or 7, then the middle of your sleep is between 2 and 4. And that really fits well into our circadian rhythm, our biological basis for it. This other thing is called sleep efficiency. And it's really how much time are you actually in bed and how much time are you actually asleep? If you take that as a ratio and it's somewhere between, say, 85%, 90%, 95%, you're doing quite well. If it's somewhere around 60, 70, 75%, you're spending an awful lot of time in bed wishing you were sleeping, but you're not sleeping. So one of the biggest suggestions around the management of insomnia is please don't be in bed if you're not sleeping. So maybe we'll come back to that. Sleep duration is one of them. So one of the six components of assessing your sleep is to think about how much sleep you're getting. But the number of hours changes with age. So when we are teenager, early 20s, we might be pushing to get to the other side of 8 hours, moving into 9 hours potentially. When we're 40, 50, 60, 7 hours is often enough. And then when we get into our years of retirement, then it might be 6 to 8 hours each individual. And those are the averages, like those are the ranges. And we might be getting maybe a bit of a nap sometimes when we didn't do that when we're younger. So it's good to think of the range of sleep duration as opposed to this magical number that everybody knows. And I don't even want to say it on the podcast because I feel like it only reinforces that magical number, those two loops on top of each other. And regularity. So we think of it's the weekend. I can sleep in. I can go to bed really late. And that really sets you up for having some sleep difficulties if your variation is dramatic. And this is why, for some people who, unfortunately for them, but we need people to do it, which is shift work. It can be a real challenge for people to feel like, I'm still a good sleeper, even though I am a shift worker. That is one of the most difficult components of being a shift worker. So those are the six components that I think when we think of them all together, then we don't have to prioritize one over the other, but we can work a little bit on each one or just one at a time or another. So those are the ways
Because
I think of it.
a lot of people get very fixated on numbers. You know,
Yes.
I need 8 hours sleep. I mean, I'm these weird p person that, I'll go to bed at 10 o'clock, but I'm up at 4 in the morning
Right.
consistently.
Yeah.
And that's so from 4 to probably noon is my most productive time. I get a whole bunch of work done, and I
Yeah.
developed that really early when the kids were younger. And I'm actually very grateful for that habit, even though people look at me and they think, "What? You get up at 4? That's usually when we're going to sleep." So,
Yep.
but I think it's whatever our patterns are. But what we often find in the chronic pain population, which is kind of interesting, is you'll see this pattern where they'll reverse their days and nights.
Right.
And often, I mean, the way I try to frame it for patients is that sometimes when you're living with chronic pain, it gets very hard to try and explain to people, why you're experiencing pain or why you're not able to do something at that time. And it's almost like a coping strategy. You reverse the days and nights so you don't have to talk to people. You don't have to interact. I don't know if that is something, because when I think of sleep, is that, because it's, I'm going to jump around a little bit, because the other piece that I think is important, I think the whole thing around how we develop habits around sleep can begin at a very young age. And even that reversal pattern becomes a habit, right? Because it works. Our brain is always going to move towards something that is going to work for us. It doesn't have to make sense to anybody else, but it makes sense to our nervous system, right? But one of the things that I've often found, although I've never seen any studies on this, it'd be interesting to pick your brain, is that oftentimes, especially if you have an individual, and we know that our populations who are living with pain, as well as living with substance use disorders, things like that, they often have a significant amount of adverse childhood experiences in their life.
Right.
And often they have a lot of unpredictability and in unsafe. When I say unsafe, I mean that where they don't feel safe. I mean, they start to develop
Yeah.
hypervigilance. But then
Yeah.
they can get into this pattern of
Yeah.
staying awake to
Yeah.
stay alive.
Sure. Yep.
And so when they get into that, because our brain is always looking for safety as well, it's always looking for a place to feel calm and safe, right? It doesn't like the chaos.
Right.
And that may be sometimes what we'll see, especially as the child gets older and is not able to kind of, reprogram themselves to get back to sleep, is that that's where we sometimes see things coming in, like substances, like self-medicating or,
Yeah.
different kinds of strategies. I'm just curious about your thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, I think nothing's black and white, and we don't just apply the same rules to everybody. So
Yes.
for individuals to find what works for them, it can be quite different than for somebody else. And we're not trying to say everybody needs to fit in the exact same box.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you start to associate a certain place, like the bedroom, with not feeling safe, or a certain time, and not feeling safe, then you don't want to be there, and you don't want to feel vulnerable. And if nodding off in that place at that time, or being asleep at that time, is associated with that. So that's a really deep, challenging issue
Yeah.
that goes beyond sort of self-care and trying to figure things out. Like you really would benefit from having good counseling, therapeutic, psychological
Yeah.
care to help you work through those kind of things. I'm not saying people should always try to be the way we are, diurnal, sleeping at night and awake during the day. But for your overall health in the long term, this would be great if that was something that you could gradually, through some sort of therapy, move towards, so that your night and your bedroom is associated with you just falling fast asleep right away and waking up
Yeah.
in the morning and feeling like, oh, that's another reasonable sleep that I just had. And so
Yeah, and it doesn't have to
by
be.
avoiding all of that, then
Yeah.
you'll never get there. So I'm not saying you have to, but in many cases,
Yeah.
it would be good for you to work through those kind of issues and try to get yourself back onto
Oh,
a typical
absolutely.
circadian
Yeah.
rhythm.
I use it sometimes in the conversation. You try to, and it doesn't have to be big things. It doesn't have to be big things. I mean,
Right.
you could have a child, and I don't know if there was one, a little bit of reading that I've done around sensory processing sensitivity, not from the autistic perspective, but kids that actually just feel things differently, right? They often are very sensitive to their environments, and a
Yeah.
lot of this stuff kind of gets replayed at night. And yeah, so I mean, I just find the whole thing with sleep often can be a gateway for me clinically to kind of look at patients, just their stories, because that's what makes them unique. And so you can kind of get a sense of what they grew up in and what for them. Like for me, I was a terrible sleeper as a kid, but I used to always think there were penguins living under my, I don't know why penguins,
Okay.
that's what I'm saying. It doesn't have to make
Yeah.
sense to
Yeah,
anybody.
exactly. Yeah.
And even my kids laugh, right? It's just, I said, I don't know. Growing up as a kid, I used to think, I mean, we all think that there are monsters under there, but and probably watched too many scary shows because we were the youngest of seven, right? So the older kids would be
Yeah.
watching scary shows. And then anyway, we're going to kind of divert there.
Well, I just as a last thought, I do think it's important to for people to hear about, we self-label. So some people have told me, oh, I've been an insomniac my whole life. And by making that statement, I think they're telling me, you don't have to worry about me because that can't change because that is who I am. And so if we say, all right, we have to kind of work through your self-identity and that's who you think you are. But let's just imagine 2 months from now, you're actually sleeping well. So what would that be like? Like, would you call yourself an insomniac anymore? Or is this something that, might be something we can erode just a little bit over time and try to address? So I think we get stuck. Like, this is a normal thing. We get stuck and we go, there's nothing I can do. And maybe Maureen will talk a lot about medication use as the quick fix for these kind of things. But if we can get people to say, that's one road, but it doesn't tend to actually get to the underlying reasons why I'm having difficulty sleeping. And so trying to move people so that they can challenge their preconceptions and move beyond them.
Well, we can also get into, I mean, we know that we can develop something called pain anticipation, where the brain gets very focused on pain, but it also is fearful of worsening pain, right? So that pain anticipation, so you can get into sleep anticipation as well, where people actually just build themselves up around just, do I really have to go there? I don't want to go there. I don't want to. So they, they've created all of this fear around even trying to sleep or even being awake. I mean, my mother used to have a clock that she would put the hours on the ceiling. And I thought that would drive me crazy. And I thought, why would I want to wake up and know what time it is, and just kind of start to ruminate around that, right? So, but yeah,
If anybody's listening and they have that clock, please turn it off.
yeah, exactly. We parked it after she passed gracefully through this world, but nobody wanted to take it. There were no takers. So you brought up medication, so I think that's really important. So can we talk about how medication can facilitate, how it can harm, and how we want to look at it as a tool, right? In a toolbox around individuals who are struggling with sleep.
So maybe by the if we fast forward 10 or 20 minutes, people will go, this guy's so anti-medication. Well,
No.
I'm a pharmacist, and so I think it's important for people to recognize my goal is the optimal use of medications, and that does not mean the higher use of medications. So there is totally a role for medications in relation to sleep difficulties. And there's a whole variety of different types of sleep disorders. When we focus on insomnia specifically, the role of sleep medications is actually really small in terms of what we think is optimal care for insomnia. But sleep medications go beyond insomnia, and there's other disorders where we think, oh, this is where a specific medication might be ideal for that individual. But for insomnia, we talk about melatonin. Melatonin has been studied really well. Like, there's really good data on melatonin. When we do really good studies, we often compare a treatment to a placebo, and the people in the studies can't tell what they're getting. And that's how good melatonin is for insomnia. It is as good as the other group getting the placebo. So the placebo is actually really effective in sleep studies because people are now in a sleep study, they're getting good care overall, and they're focused on their sleep. And they're understanding that maybe some of the habits that they were having before they went into the study are maladaptive to their sleep. So they're doing a variety of things in addition to taking whatever they're getting in the study. So I think it just shows us how effective a little bit of behavior change, and we know a lot of benefits through behavior change and cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. So first and foremost, maybe I could just sort of say The people that benefit from melatonin are youth who have specific issues that are not necessarily insomnia. So if you have ADHD and you're taking stimulants and the stimulant is wearing off, there's some good data to show that melatonin is quite effective for those kind of individuals. But if you're 55 and you've got menopause and you've got insomnia and you're thinking, oh, I'll go natural and I'll take melatonin, there's really good data to say that for adults and older adults with insomnia, it's not going to actually add anything to the benefits of behavior change. So let's move on to the sleeping pills that you can get in other ways. So melatonin is one of them, but then there's a variety of prescription medications that are used, and there's some over-the-counter medications as well. So one class of medications in how we increase sleepiness is to take an antihistamine medication. Now, as somebody who thinks about it broadly pharmacologically, there's lots of drugs not called antihistamines that are potent antihistamines. So, a very low dose of some antidepressants and actually some antipsychotics, all they're doing is providing antihistaminic effects. And some people are getting prescribed antidepressants and antipsychotics at very low doses just because of their antihistaminic effects. And you can get that same antihistaminic effect when you walk into a drugstore and you take a nighttime version of a cough and cold medication that has an antihistamine like diphenhydramine. There's other antihistamines you get in the drugstore that don't penetrate the blood-brain barrier, and they are not sedating. You have to get into the brain for it to be sedating. But if you have an antihistamine or a drug that's not even called an antihistamine that blocks histamine, you are blocking part of the system that keeps you awake. So when you're interfering with wakefulness through taking antihistamines. The problem with antihistamines is very often they make you feel groggy the next morning, and they have something called anticholinergic side effects that go along with antihistaminic effects. So, with every single medication that we take, you're always getting more than you bargained for. The mechanism of action is what we talk about, but you usually get other pharmacological effects. So, that's one approach. A different approach is, which is the most common prescription approach to, treating insomnia, is a class of drugs called the Z drugs and benzodiazepines. And I group those together because they work by the same mechanism. There is a chemical in our brain called GABA, and GABA is associated with getting our brain ready to fall asleep. So it enhances the brain's ability to calm down and just take on sleep when we're ready for it. So we give drugs that enhance that, and those drugs are the ones that are associated with also the concerns of dependence and withdrawal when we stop them. So when we talk about benzodiazepines and Z drugs, Zopiclone is Canada's favorite prescription sleeping pill by far. And we know that it is like the others in the Z drug benzodiazepine class, where people can have quite a difficult time coming off of it. When I say people, I'm saying the minority of people. If you've been taking benzodiazepines or Z drugs just by habit for years for getting a good night's sleep, and you kind of say, if I don't take it, I don't get a good night's sleep. It doesn't mean you can't get a good night's sleep without it, and it doesn't mean you're going to go through a horrific withdrawal. Some people have a difficult time coming off of it. To minimize that problem, we gradually help people come off of it. Now, that can be several weeks, and it can even be several months for somebody to have years and years and years of taking these medications come to a relatively simple and uneventful end. And people can actually even do this on their own, guided with some information. And our website has some resources around how to actually do that. So that's two, well, now three classes. Melatonin, the drugs that have antihistaminic effects that enter the brain, benzodiazepines and Z drugs. And then there's another class called the DORAs. It's a new class of medications that's got a couple of medications in Canada, daridorexant and lemborexant. Like the antihistamines, the DORAs interfere with wakefulness. And so they let the balance shift towards the brain chemicals that support the brain falling asleep. So they're taking away the part that's involved with wakefulness. And the way they do that is not associated with as much concern around withdrawal effects when you stop it abruptly or dependence on the medications. There's some data to suggest there's some concerns about overuse and people taking very high doses of it to get the same effect. So we don't know enough about them because they're relatively new. Some of the issues associated with these medications relate to our REM sleep, our rapid eye movement sleep, which we tend to notice more in the morning when we're waking up, but we also have it on and off throughout the night. And there can be a little bit of a mistake by the brain because of these medications. Am I awake or am I asleep? And so some people experience dreams while being awake or even with their being able to see things. So they have these hallucinations, and we call some of this sleep paralysis, where you're actually conscious, but your body will not move. So when we have REM sleep, our body is actually paralyzed, so we can't act out our dreams. But because these medications are interfering with that system itself, a very small number of people will actually wake up and realize they're awake, but they're paralyzed. So imagine how scary that is. It only lasts for a short period of time, like seconds to minutes, but you also might see things in your dreams, but be awake. So it's like you're actually seeing what you're seeing and realizing there is somebody in my room, or I'm hearing somebody come up, or something like that. So every medication that I talked about has some ability to help you get a good night's sleep, but it also has some concerns. And the amount of benefit is worth talking about, which is you get to sleep about 10 minutes faster, and you probably sleep for, say, 15 minutes longer on average across all the well-designed studies. That's what these medications are getting you.
Interesting. I didn't realize that. And the whole thing around sleep paralysis, I thought I didn't realize like that actually is considered to be something that can happen to almost anyone, sleep paralysis, right?
Yeah.
So it's actually so even the suffocating form of it, I can just imagine having that it's almost be like like a ketamine effect in some ways. Your brain is,
Yeah.
depending on how much ketamine they're giving them, but not able to move your body at all, not able to respond would be just absolutely terrifying. I just want to come back to a point though you mentioned, because I see, especially in our Alzheimer population, a lot of melatonin that's actually prescribed. Do you think there's actually any benefit to that population with melatonin?
I think the data is really poor, and I think the anecdotes are we tried it, it didn't work. We tried it and didn't work. We tried it. But a lot of people don't do the follow-up. They get started, especially in the care system where people are getting desperate. You know, people who have dementia, their sleep can be so turned upside down, and then it goes back to normal for a while, and then it gets turned upside down, and you know, the behavior issues. So it can be really challenging for the care providers. And so a sleep medication seems like the right thing, but then you go, well, did it work? We'll go, I don't know. Are you still having these issues? Well, yes, we are. So should we double the dose? And it's like, well, I don't know if we should double the dose. Maybe we should stop the dose because it's just adding to the burden of medications. So
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I'm not an advocate for melatonin in that. The science on this, if anything, is pointing to it not being effective at all, but overall it's
It's
not
probably
supportive.
therapeutic for the prescriber because at least you feel like you're not doing harm, but you're obviously adding an extra burden. And I think just to highlight in terms of the Z drugs, I'm also the physician for prescription monitoring. And I always find it amazing that we don't monitor Zolpidem out of all the Z drugs. So they monitor everything else, but even with the absence of Zolpidem, I'm sure Nova Scotia would have the highest prescribing rate anywhere in Canada. But as it stands now, the Atlantic region is the highest prescribers of benzodiazepine-like drugs anywhere in Canada. And now, mind you, the numbers are starting to come down a little bit, but still, it's crazy when you see, I always say you never should use a drug like a benzodiazepine for a chronic condition, right? Just like, yeah. So there's even some arguments now around we shouldn't be using opioids for chronic pain, right? And because the evidence is not overwhelming. Where I find these drugs, I don't use them at all, actually, unless it's in an inpatient, like when I'm doing withdrawal therapy and things like that from an opiate or from a alcohol use disorder. What I always say to prescribers is that the role of pharmacology can have a role, but primarily for our patients. So our patients that are coming to us are incredibly motivated, right? They have a lot of motivation. they want to feel better, and we're going to give them a tool that actually is totally inefficient, right? But often what these tools are about are not about creating the environment where they're going to do better. It allows sometimes that threat, right? That I got to do this, you know, there's a lot of intensity. They just feel a lot of threat with not sleeping around the pain, is that we're trying to lower the threshold enough to take them from a high intensity to moderate so we can actually bring in the skills. Because a lot of times it's not about the motivation or willpower. It's about understanding what's going on, but also what kinds of tools or skills I need. So maybe what you can do, David, is take us through some of the tools that you offer on your, and I'm thinking of different tools. Like for me, pain reprocessing therapy would be a really good thing about pain, but for you, it's going to be cognitive behavioral. But if you can kind of expand these really important skills that are not going to come intuitively or naturally, we have to learn them. A lot of people think, oh yeah, I'm just going to sit and meditate and be mindful. And, but these are skills that we need to learn them, right? We need to be able to incorporate them. And it takes some time, but I'd just be curious about your thoughts. Yeah.
You said so many things that I would love to chat about there. When somebody is on a medication for sleep, they often have a very strong relationship with that medication, and they are, as you say, they are not ready to divorce themselves from that medication, and it's a very difficult conversation to have. But it becomes a lot easier if you say, well, there is actually a different therapy. It's considered to be first line therapy, and it is more effective in the long run, and it is a short term therapy. So 4 to 8 weeks of this therapy is how long you need it. And it probably will change your relationship with your sleeping pill. So if you're not ready for us to talk about reducing your dose and coming off of the not do this therapy anyway, and at some point maybe you will be ready. So there's good data from a variety of different studies from elsewhere that shows if you just give people CBTI and they're taking sleeping pills, but you don't talk about or don't do anything, they start to reduce their use, and many people just naturally stop taking their sleeping pills. So it could be a stated goal or an unstated goal that we want to help you reduce your dependence or use or reliance on these medications, but ultimately it is a way that that's one of the potential outcomes. But to go back to another point, we talk about insomnia disorder as living with insomnia, having difficulty having getting a good night's sleep on 3 nights or more per week for at least 3 months or longer. There's so many people that fit that diagnosis. So insomnia disorder is also referred to as chronic insomnia. And when we think of chronic disease management, we're thinking about things like diabetes, and you've had a heart attack, and now after your heart attack, you're going to take medications to prevent future heart attack in the long run. So you've got cardiovascular risk factors. All these kind of things are the chronic disease management. And we think of the word chronic in that, in those cases, quite legitimately. Chronic insomnia can be gone in 4 to 8 weeks of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. So should we actually call it a chronic disease? Is the word chronic making us go, oh, I have to take sleeping pills forever because it's managing my chronic problem? And I think we really need to rethink how we approach chronic insomnia and put it over as, oh, it's just non-optimally treated insomnia. And if we could get somebody to go through a trial of CBTI.
Well, it also reflects that this is really about neuroplasticity, right? It's really about the habits and behaviors that we develop in order to meet whatever it is that we need in our life, right? So the same thing with chronic pain. If you look at the evidence now around pain reprocessing therapy, in particular somatic tracking, you know, it is now recognized as level one evidence. And there have actually been cases. So, I mean, imagine us thinking about chronic pain as a reversible condition. So, in some of these cases, especially around fibromyalgia, they've been able to actually reverse that nociplastic component, right? So that we've never been able to say
Really
that.
interesting.
Fascinating stuff, David. If you ever want to look at this stuff, I always encourage patients. So what I always say is I tell patients, because we have to be careful how we increase the amount of threat by our presentation to the patient, but when we're trying to bring about changes that we think can improve their quality of life, because it's really not about me, it's their journey, right? I tell people I'm just like the plumber. I'm just coming with some advice, and you can take that advice or you can say, nope, I'm going to leave it. But one way I get patients to buy in, it sounds very similar to what you do, is that I say to them, don't stop anything you're doing. These are tools that you have found that have worked for you, but let's find ways to expand your toolbox to actually bring in other therapies. So when patients, so even when they're going through the pain self-management, I'm going to use it as a pain thing, I tell them, don't stop anything. I don't want you to stop your medication. I don't want to stop the tools. Don't, if you're going to massage 3 times a week or you're seeing it, because we now have evidence, even interventional procedures to the spine actually are not improving the quality of life for patients with chronic pain. But you have to look at the legacy patient very different than somebody that's just coming in to get the therapy, right? I say, I don't want you to stop any of that. But what we're going to do is take you through this 10-week program that really provides an evidence, like a pain neuroscience kind of thing, or evidence-based. It includes the sleep and the nutrition. And invariably, I get 3 patients by the end saying, can you take me off my medications? By the end of it, I'm like, okay, well, let's just work with your prescriber first. But because we don't have a lot of evidence that a lot of the pharmacology we're using is actually improving the quality of life for patients. But where I do find it can be helpful is helping to lower down that threat a bit so you can bring in those skills. Like if a patient's in a high threat brain, right? I call it a threat landscape. If they've got a lot of intensity of an experience, they're feeling a lot of threat. So they're not going to feel safe in any environment. And then there's no way you're going to bring in new skills for those patients, right? You have to find a way to lower threat, and obviously we can do it by our presentation, but sometimes medication can help a little bit. But I don't use any benzos for sleep at all. Because I find there I can't as a physician I can't compete with these medications, right? Once a patient gets on these medications, it's very, very hard to stop. But it can be totally appropriate in certain conditions, right? So, but I have to make sure that I'm looking at that evidence as well. But so I think, I think it's so important to, we talk about this refrain, meet the patient where they are. Yeah, just don't change anything, but let's just expand your toolbox. Let's see what else we can bring in here that might actually help you make progress and get you unstuck, because they're using all of that dopamine to sort of stay in a certain state of brain, just focus very much on pain and focus on staying out of pain. But we want them to focus more on living their life, right?
Our approach has really been, we talk about this thing called the step care model, and there's step care models for this, that, and the other thing. But for the management of sleep problems like insomnia, it really works well. So most people could manage chronic insomnia on their own with maybe a little bit of support, and other people will require a lot of support. But the masses don't need highly trained individuals who are experts in CBTI. They need to just know, like you're asking me, what are some of these tools or what are some of
Yeah.
these things, like,
Or
and
where
that,
people can access them. If you're waiting to see someone, where can they access them?
So I think right now we're a little bit programmed to, oh, I have a problem, I go see my doctor, and then we get the issues of, oh, I don't have access, or I have this or that. But there's lots of health conditions where there's things that we know you can do something about it. So our Sleep Well program really is about research and knowledge mobilization. The knowledge mobilization is we know lots of stuff and we've made tools that help you know it too and know what to do and be able to do it on your own. So I'll just mention a couple of things quickly. One is we did this study in New Brunswick, and we did it in New Brunswick because of what you were saying. Here in Atlantic Canada, our rates of sedative use are so high. Zopiclone is the number one prescribed sleeping pill in Atlantic Canada,
We
and the
don't even track it in Nova Scotia. Just think about
I wanted to add, I was just in
that.
New Brunswick last week, and they track it there, and there are other provinces that track it. It's our choice in Nova Scotia to not track it. And Maureen, the MP has heard from me quite a few times about tracking Zopiclone. And if you have influence that I don't have, maybe you could put it back on the agenda as something that we really do need to track.
I
They're
agree.
actually tracking the DORAs in other provinces, even though they're also not control drugs, because they are seeing some misuse with extremely high doses on an individual level basis. But anyway, that's a bit of a sideline. To come back to what we did in New Brunswick was this randomized trial where we created a mail out that told people about their sleeping pills, what the concerns are, and how to safely stop them. And a book that was one booklet, and the second booklet was how to get a good night's how to get your sleep back. So how to get a good night's sleep without sleeping pills was the focus, and that was our introduction to cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And it told people what the components were, and it also said if you want to actually access CBTI and do it on your own, there are different resources out there. And that's all the study was, a mail out. 6 months later, the average person was 72 coming into the study and had been taking zopiclone or a benzodiazepine, some Z drug or benzodiazepine for 11 years on average. 26% stopped their zopiclone or other benzodiazepines and did not switch to any other sleeping pill because of the embedded behavior change information that was in the booklets, as well as providing them with sleep-enhancing techniques that are part of CBTI. It wasn't a CBTI program, but it was all self-guided. So we know that people can actually have agency, have identified issues with self-efficacy, read some of these booklets, build their self-efficacy, have the capacity and capability of doing it. And now they've got some motivation to do it because they've reflected on, I've been taking this for a decade or two. I don't want to be taking it for another decade or two.
And I think that what you're saying is really important. So how we frame motivation. So when we have so what I think about is what I call away from motivation and towards motivation. So when our focus is on getting rid of something, right? I want to get rid of these pills. I want to, lose weight, whatever it is. I want to get rid of pain. I mean, that's a white knuckling willpower kind of thing that often fails. But if we move towards a positive sensation, like, so for a patient, I would, especially around sleep, I would move towards feeling more energy through the day. I would move towards feeling more enjoyment or joy through the day because you're more aware, right? So you're moving towards that positive sensation. And that kind of motivation really helps people looking at it differently rather than saying, okay, that's my, it's like, I mean, I know it's a lot of the ways that we design a lot of these therapies about stopping certain things like smoking and things, but it does matter because when our focus is on getting rid of something and that's only our focus, then that requires we almost always never do well with that. But before we finish, if there's one thing that you think that you could leave with listeners, one practical lesson about sleep, what would it be?
I don't know if it's one. It's a c combined.
Okay, I'm okay with that.
We'll call it one combined idea. So you talked about habits, and really, when we think of addressing a long-standing issue with insomnia, and I think it's important for people to understand. So there's this model called the 3P model. You know, a lot of people are born with a higher chance of having insomnia, and so that's just part of our makeup. Or different people will have a higher chance of it. There's a precipitating event that causes us to have insomnia, but then it's the perpetuating factor. So we do these maladaptive things like, oh, I'm going to nap this afternoon. And that reduces something called our sleep drive. Or we go to bed early, hoping tonight it's going to be a better sleep. And all we do is toss and turn. And we build up this association of being in our bed and being frustrated. So you talked about anticipating pain. Well, people anticipate insomnia. And if you're anticipating anything, your mind is not resting. It is
It's
not,
threat. It's threat.
it's the opposite of being ready to fall asleep. So what we need people to do is allow for that to fix itself. Some of these underlying things that keep it going can be fixed. And you need to allow your brain to say the bed is actually associated with sleep. So what the message is try to reduce your time in bed, not increase your time in bed, until most of the time that you're in bed is sleeping. And then gradually build up your time in bed very slowly so that it is consistently built up as more sleep time in bed than just time in bed. So the big takeaway message here is only go to bed when you're actually feeling sleepy and ready to sleep. And if you don't happen to fall asleep because all of a sudden your mind wakes up because it's currently still trained to be very active when you're in bed, leave the bed, leave the bedroom, and go back when you're ready to sleep. So people say 15 minutes, 20 minutes is how long you should tolerate being in bed and not being asleep. And if it's longer than that, without looking at a clock, it's just a best guess. It doesn't have to be perfect. You leave the bedroom and come back. So that is the behavior change that so many people say it was so hard and so important and so effective, and I'm glad you forced me to go through it. So that is it. Less time in bed to start, to associate your bed with actually being so tired that you just sleep and you break that conditioned response of your brain being very active. People talk about it as my mind racing after the light goes out. It's not racing before the light goes out, but it's after the light goes out. How are you going to break that habit? How are you actually going to be sleepy and sleeping when you're in bed, when you've got all of these months or even years of the opposite actually happening? So the
Yeah.
behavior change is where to start.
Absolutely. And I when you say this, I remember my mother always saying, my poor mother, she used to say, "You know what, Maureen?" She said, "All you need to do is put an X through it." And I remember as a kid her saying, "Put an X through it." And I went, "What does she mean, put an X through it?" But
Right.
literally as an adult, I
Yes.
literally put an X through it. It's just so crazy. And I think the other thing that I want to leave listeners with too is that, we want, we have to come at these things with kindness and compassion because we are doing the best we can in that moment. And we can be so critical of ourselves. But I think it's just having a whole bunch of courage to recognize there are some things I want to change, that I'm not happy about something, and that you're willing to kind of take that on. And I think web pages like yours are making a huge difference. And I do use them on a regular basis. So I thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with me today, David. And
Can I propose one more thing? So we just got
Sure.
ethics approval to test a couple of new resources that are like simple resources, and we're inviting people who identify as having insomnia to reach
Oh.
out to us, and we're identifying clinicians to also reach out to us, and we will share the resources as part of a study so we can get
Nice.
feedback as to how people experience those resources before we trial them in a clinical trial. We just want to, adjust them, get some
Yeah.
feedback as to from both perspectives of clinicians and from patients. So the quickest
Interesting.
way to email us is at S as in Sam, Peter, Sam. So SPS at DAL, DAL dot CA. SPS
Nice.
started off as a study that we did a while ago, which was about sleeping pills. So it was sleeping pill study, but it's not a, this is not a sleeping pill study, but it's SPS at dal.ca.
Nice. And would there be a conflict of interest if I suggest that my husband call you?
You
He's got every one of your the books and the web page and everything, and he still struggles. But yeah, so but I lots of people even in the group. So I will if you're if how many participants are you looking for? As many as possible? Or do you have a
yeah.
limit?
We're looking for 50 individuals, so
Okay.
patients, and I think we're somewhere around 20 clinicians will give us a good idea of if we're going in the right direction or if we need to make some changes. And it's not
Okay.
about sleeping pills. It's really all about what I just talked to you about, these different
Yes.
techniques that you can learn on your own. So one of
Yes.
the resources is called 3-in-1, 3 habits and 1 tool for better sleep. So something that's really
Nice.
palpable, easy to work through. It's very
Yeah.
short. And then there's another one, which is actually a workbook on CBTI. So some people might be ready to do the full 4 weeks to 8 week program, and they
Yeah.
can do it on their own. So that's where we're at.
Oh, I'm sure there's, you would not have any trouble recruiting that many people. So, are you looking for primary care? I mean, even as a
Yes.
physician, it does. So, you're looking at primary care. Okay.
Yeah. Anybody
Awesome.
who, it could be somebody who works in a pain clinic, but really where the meat and potatoes of insomnia care happen right now is in primary care. So
Exactly.
that would be really a high priority for us.
Yeah, exactly. We see a lot. I mean, there are lots of patients that we see through the eMERGE as well, but sleep is one of those things that just shows up in so many different clinical spaces, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, David, thank you so much. And I definitely will reach out again because like I said, I've got 2 pages of questions, but this is such an important topic. And I'm always picking people's brains about, like, I'm going to talk to Dr. Gardner. Is there anything you want us to know or ask him that you could probably reach out to your office too? Not that I want you to get inundated, but I think the more information, the better. I mean, that's what empowers our patients to live quality of life, right?
Yeah.
Good.
So this was a good start, Maureen. Thanks.
Yeah, no,
We'll
thank you
continue
so
on.
much. And I appreciate you taking your time because I know you're busy as well.